The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. With the recent release of the movie Oppenheimer, coinciding with the 78th anniversary of the nuclear attack on Japan by the U.S. on August 6, 1945, for the last 3 weeks, I have been reading the story Hiroshima, by John Hersey. A first-hand account of the human impact on citizens of Hiroshima, published as the entire August 31st, 1946 edition of the New Yorker magazine. Hersey was dispatched by the New Yorker to Hiroshima in May of 1946 to write an article describing the human impacts of the bomb. In plain, spare prose, Hersey documented scenes of unprecedented ruin and human suffering, capturing the ghostly residuum of calamity. Hersey organized his article around six survivors he interviewed in Hiroshima, ordinary Japanese with families, friends, and jobs just like Americans. Hersey writes that 100,000 people were killed by the atomic bomb, and these six were among the survivors, leaving them to still wonder why they lived when so many others died, or too busy or too weary or too badly hurt to care that they were the objects of the first great experiment in the use of atomic power, which no country except the United States, with its industrial know-how, its willingness to throw $2 billion gold dollars into an important wartime gamble, could possibly have developed. The August 31st, 1946 Hiroshima edition of the New Yorker sold out almost immediately on newsstands, with Albert Einstein even attempting to buy 1,000 copies. Later serialized in newspapers across the country, Hersey's Hiroshima became the first human account of the attack for most Americans. To this day, it remains one of the most important works of journalism ever created. This week I will read the final section of the story. If you missed any of the previous ones, you can find them at our website, ncreadingservice.org, under the podcast section, New Yorker Magazine. So with no further ado, the finale of Hiroshima by John Hersey. By the end of the first week in September, Father Kleinsorge was in bed at the novitiate with a fever of 102.2. And since he seemed to be getting worse, his colleagues decided to send him to the Catholic International Hospital in Tokyo. Father Sislik and the rector took him as far as Kobe, and a Jesuit from that city took him the rest of the way, with a message from a Kobe doctor to the Mother Superior of the International Hospital. The message read, "Think twice before you give this man blood transfusions, because with atomic bomb patients, we aren't at all sure that if you stick needles in them, they'll stop bleeding." When Father Kleinsorge arrived at the hospital, he was terribly pale and very shaky. He complained that the bomb had upset his digestion and given him abdominal pains. His white blood count was 3,000. 5,000 to 7,000 is normal. He was seriously anemic, and his temperature was 104. A doctor who did not know much about these strange manifestations, Father Kleinsorge was one of a handful of atomic patients who had reached Tokyo, came to see him, and to the patient's face he was most encouraging. "You'll be out of here in 2 weeks," he said. But when the doctor got out in the corridor, he said to the Mother Superior, "He'll die. All these bomb people die. You'll see. They go along for a couple of weeks, and then they die." The doctor prescribed supplementation for Father Kleinsorge. Every 3 hours, they forced some eggs or beef juice into him, and they fed him all the sugar he could stand. They gave him vitamins and iron pills and arsenic, in Fowler's solution, for his anemia. He confounded both the doctor's predictions. He neither died nor got up in a fortnight. Despite the fact that the message from the Kobe doctor deprived him of transfusions, which would have been the most useful therapy of all, His fever and his digestive troubles cleared up fairly quickly. His white count went up for a while, but early in October it dropped again to 3,600. Then, in 10 days, it suddenly climbed above normal to 8,800, and it finally settled at 5,800. His ridiculous scratches puzzled everyone. For a few days they would mend, and then, when he moved around, they would open up again. As soon as he began to feel well, he enjoyed himself tremendously. In Hiroshima, he had been one of thousands of sufferers. In Tokyo, he was a curiosity. Young American army doctors came by the dozen to observe him. Japanese experts questioned him. A newspaper interviewed him. And once, the confused doctor came and shook his head and said, "Baffling cases, these atomic bomb people." Mrs. Nakamura lay indoors with Maiko. They both continued sick, and though Mrs. Nakamura vaguely sensed that their trouble was caused by the bomb, she was too poor to see a doctor, and so never knew exactly what the matter was. Without any treatment at all, but merely resting, they began gradually to feel better. Some of Maiko's hair fell out, and she had a tiny burn on her arm which took months to heal. The boy, Toshio, and the older girl, Yaiko, seemed well enough, though they, too, lost some hair and occasionally had bad headaches. Toshio was still having nightmares, always about the 19-year-old mechanic, Hideo Asaki, his hero, who had been killed by the bomb. On his back, with a fever of 104, Mr. Tanimoto worried about all the funerals he ought to be conducting for the deceased of his church. He thought he was just overtired from the hard work he had done since the bombing. But after the fever had persisted for a few days, he sent for a doctor. The doctor was too busy to visit him in Ushida, but he dispatched a nurse, who recognized his symptoms as those of mild radiation disease and came back from time to time to give him injections of vitamin B1. A Buddhist priest with whom Mr. Tanimoto was acquainted called on him and suggested that moxibustion might give him relief. The priest showed the pastor how to give himself the ancient Japanese treatment by setting fire to a twist of the stimulant herb moxa placed on the wrist pulse. Mr. Tanimoto found that each moxa treatment temporarily reduced his fever 1 degree. The nurse had told him to eat as much as possible, and every few days his mother-in-law brought him vegetables and fish from Tsutsu, 20 miles away where she lived. He spent a month in bed and then went 10 hours by train to his father's home in Shikoku. There he rested another month. Dr. Sasaki and his colleagues at the Red Cross Hospital watched the unprecedented disease unfold and at last evolved a theory about its nature. It had, they decided, 3 stages. The first stage had been all over before the doctors even knew they were dealing with a new sickness. It was the direct reaction to the bombardment of the body at the moment when the bomb went off by neutrons, beta particles, and gamma rays. The apparently uninjured people who had died so mysteriously in the first few hours or days had succumbed in this first stage. It killed 95% of the people within a half mile of the center, and many thousands who were farther away. The doctors realized in retrospect that even though most of these dead had also suffered from burns and blast effects, they had absorbed enough radiation to kill them. The rays simply destroyed body cells, caused their nuclei to degenerate and broke their walls. Many people who did not die right away came down with nausea, headache, diarrhea, malaise, and fever, which lasted several days. Doctors could not be certain whether some of these symptoms were the result of radiation or nervous shock. The second stage set in 10 or 15 days after the bombing. The main symptom was falling hair. Diarrhea and fever, which in some cases went as high as 106, came next. 25 to 30 days after the explosion, blood disorders appeared. Gums bled, the white blood cell count dropped sharply, and petechiae appeared on the skin and mucous membranes. The drop in the number of white blood corpuscles reduced the patient's capacity to resist infection. So open wounds were unusually slow in healing, and many of the sick developed sore throats and mouths. The two key symptoms on which the doctors came to base their prognosis were fever and the lowered white corpuscle count. If fever remained steady and high, the patient's chances for survival were poor. The white count almost always dropped below 4,000. A patient whose count fell below 1,000 had little hope of living. Toward the end of the second stage, if the patient survived, anemia or a drop in the red blood count also set in. The third stage was the reaction that came when the body struggled to compensate for its ills. When, for instance, the white count not only returned to normal, but increased to much higher than normal levels. In this stage, many patients died of complications, such as infections in the chest cavity. Most burns healed with deep layers of pink, rubbery scar tissue known as chelioid tumors. The duration of the disease varied depending on the patient's constitution and the amount of radiation he had received. Some victims recovered in a week. With others, the disease dragged on for months. As the symptoms revealed themselves, it became clear that many of them resembled the effects of overdoses of X-ray, and the doctors based their therapy on that likeness. They gave victims liver extract, blood transfusions, and vitamins, especially B1. The shortage of supplies and instruments hampered them. Allied doctors who came in after the surrender found plasma and penicillin very effective. Since the blood disorders were, in the long run, the predominant factor in the disease, some of the Japanese doctors evolved a theory as to the seat of the delayed sickness. They thought that perhaps gamma rays entering the body at the time of the explosion made the phosphorus in the victim's bones radioactive, and that they in turn emitted beta particles, which, though they could not penetrate far through flesh, could enter the bone marrow, where blood is manufactured and gradually tear it down. Whatever its source, the disease had some baffling quirks. Not all the patients exhibited all the main symptoms. People who suffered flash burns were protected, to a considerable extent, from radiation sickness. Those who had lain quietly for days or even hours after the bombing were much less liable to get sick than those who had been active. Gray hair seldom fell out. And, as if nature were protecting man against his own ingenuity, the reproductive processes were affected for a time. Men became sterile. Women had miscarriages. Menstruation stopped. For 10 days after the flood, Dr. Fujii lived in the peasant's house on the mountain above the Ota. Then he heard about a vacant private clinic in Kaitaichi, a suburb to the east of Hiroshima. He bought it at once, moved there, and hung out a sign inscribed in English in honor of the conquerors. Quite recovered from his wounds, he soon built up a strong practice, and he was delighted in the evenings to receive members of the occupying forces on whom he lavished whiskey and practiced English. Giving Miss Sasaki a local anesthetic of procaine, Dr. Sasaki made an incision in her leg on October 23rd to drain the infection, which still lingered on 11 weeks after the injury. In the following days, so much pus formed that he had to dress the opening each morning and evening. A week later, she complained of great pain, so he made another incision. He cut still a third on November 9th and enlarged it on the 26th. All this time, Miss Sasaki grew weaker and weaker, and her spirits fell low. One day, the young man who had lent her his translation of De Maupassant at Hatsukaichi came to visit her. He told her that he was going to Kyushu, but that when he came back, he would like to see her again. She didn't care. Her leg had been so swollen and painful all along that the doctor had not even tried to set the fractures. And though an X-ray taken in November showed that the bones were mending, she could see under the sheet that her left leg was nearly 3 inches shorter than her right, and that her left foot was turning inward. She thought often of the man to whom she had been engaged. Someone told her he was back from overseas. She wondered what he had heard about her injuries that made him stay away. Father Kleinsorge was discharged from the hospital in Tokyo on December 19th and took a train home. On the way, 2 days later, at Yokogawa, a stop just before Hiroshima, Dr. Fuchii boarded the train. It was the first time the two men had met since before the bombing. They sat together. Dr. Fuchii said he was going to the annual gathering of his family on the anniversary of his father's death. When they started talking about their experiences, the doctor was quite entertaining as he told how his places of residence kept falling into rivers. Then he asked Father Kleinsorge how he was, and the Jesuit talked about his stay in the hospital. "The doctors told me to be cautious," he said. "They ordered me to have a 2-hour nap every afternoon." Dr. Fuchii said, "It's hard to be cautious in Hiroshima these days. Everyone seems to be so busy." A new municipal government, set up under Allied military government direction, had gone to work at last in the city hall. Citizens who had recovered from various degrees of radiation sickness were coming back by the thousand. By November 1st, the population, mostly crowded into the outskirts, was already 137,000, more than a third of the wartime peak, and the government set in motion all kinds of projects to put them to work rebuilding the city. It hired men to clear the streets, and others to gather scrap iron, which they sorted and piled in mountains opposite the city hall. Some returning residents were putting up their own shanties and huts and planting small squares of winter wheat beside them. But the city also authorized and built 400 one-family barracks. Utilities were repaired, electric lights shone again, trams started running, and employees of the waterworks fixed 70,000 leaks in mains and plumbing. A planning conference with an enthusiastic young military government officer, Lieutenant John D. Montgomery of Kalamazoo, as its advisor, began to consider what sort of city the new Hiroshima should be. The ruined city had flourished and had been an inviting target, mainly because it had been one of the most important military command and communication centers in Japan and would have become the imperial headquarters had the islands been invaded and Tokyo been captured. Now, there would be no huge military establishments to help revive the city. The planning conference, at a loss as to just what importance Hiroshima could have, fell back on rather vague cultural and paving projects. It drew maps with avenues 100 yards wide and thought seriously of preserving the half-ruined Museum of Science and Industry, more or less as it was, as a monument to the disaster, and naming it the Institute of International Amity. Statistical workers gathered what figures they could on the effects of the bomb. They reported that 78,150 people had been killed, 13,983 were missing, and 37,425 had been injured. No one in the city government pretended that these figures were accurate, though the Americans accepted them as official. And as the months went by, and more hundreds of corpses were dug up from the ruins, and as the number of unclaimed urns of ashes at the Zempoji Temple in Koi rose into the thousands, the statisticians began to say that at least 100,000 people had lost their lives in the bombing. Since many people died of a combination of causes, it was impossible to figure exactly how many were killed by each cause. But the statisticians calculated that about 25% had died of direct burns from the bomb, about 50% from other injuries, and about 20% as a result of radiation effects. The statisticians' figures on property damage were more reliable, 62,000 out of 90,000 buildings destroyed, and 6,000 more damaged beyond repair. In the heart of the city, they found only 5 modern buildings that could be used again without major repairs. This small number was by no means the fault of flimsy Japanese construction. In fact, since the 1923 earthquake, Japanese building regulations had required that the roof of each large building be able to bear a minimum load of 70 pounds per square foot. Whereas American regulations do not normally specify more than 40 pounds per square foot. Scientists swarmed into the city. Some of them measured the force that had been necessary to shift marble gravestones in the cemeteries, to knock over 22 of the 47 railroad cars in the yards at Hiroshima Station, to lift and move the concrete roadway on one of the bridges, and to perform other noteworthy acts of strength, and concluded that the pressure exerted by the explosion varied from 5.3 to 8.0 tons per square yard. Others found that mica, of which the melting point is 900 degrees centigrade, had fused on granite gravestones 380 yards from the center. That telephone poles of Cryptomeria japonica, whose carbonization temperature is 240 degrees centigrade, had been charred at 4,400 yards from the center, and that the surface of gray clay tiles of the type used in Hiroshima, whose melting point is 1,300 degrees centigrade, had dissolved at 600 yards. And after examining other significant ashes and melted bits, they concluded that the bomb's heat on the ground at the center must have been 6,000 degrees centigrade. And from further measurements of radiation, which involved, among other things, the scraping up of fission fragments from roof troughs and drain pipes as far away as the suburb of Takusu, 3,300 yards from the center, they learned some far more important facts about the nature of the bomb. General MacArthur's headquarters systematically censored all mention of the bomb in Japanese scientific publications. But soon, the fruit of the scientists' calculations became common knowledge among Japanese physicists, doctors, chemists, journalists, professors, and, no doubt, those statesmen and military men who were still in circulation. Long before the American public had been told, most of the scientists and lots of non-scientists in Japan knew, from the calculations of Japanese nuclear physicists, that a uranium bomb had exploded at Hiroshima and a more powerful one of plutonium at Nagasaki. They also knew that theoretically, one 10 times as powerful, or 20 times, could be developed. The Japanese scientists thought they knew the exact height at which the bomb at Hiroshima was exploded and the approximate weight of the uranium used. They estimated that, even with the primitive bomb used at Hiroshima, it would require a shelter of concrete 50 inches thick to protect a human being entirely from radiation sickness. The scientists had these and other details which remained subject to security in the United States printed and mimeographed and bound into little books. The Americans knew of the existence of these books, but tracing them and seeing that they did not fall into the wrong hands would have obliged the occupying authorities to set up, for this one purpose alone, an enormous police system in Japan. Altogether, the Japanese scientists were somewhat amused at the efforts of their conquerors to keep security on atomic fission. Late in February 1946, a friend of Miss Sasaki's called on Father Kleinsorge and asked him to visit her in the hospital. She had been growing more and more depressed and morbid. She seemed little interested in living. Father Kleinsorge went to see her several times. On his first visit, he kept the conversation general, formal, and yet vaguely sympathetic, and did not mention religion. Miss Sasaki herself brought it up the second time he dropped in on her. Evidently, she had had some talks with a Catholic. She asked bluntly, "If your God is so good and kind, how can he let people suffer like this?" She made a gesture which took in her shrunken leg and the other patients in her room, and Hiroshima as a whole. "My child," Father Kleinsorge said, "man is not now in the condition God intended. He has fallen from grace through sin." And he went on to explain all the reasons for everything. It came to Mrs. Nakamura's attention that a carpenter from Kabe was building a number of wooden shanties in Hiroshima, which he rented for 50 yen a month, $3.33 at the fixed rate of exchange. Mrs. Nakamura had lost the certificates for her bonds and other wartime savings, but fortunately she had copied off all the numbers just a few days before the bombing and had taken the list to Kabe. And so, when her hair had grown in enough for her to be presentable, she went to her bank in Hiroshima and a clerk there told her that after checking her numbers against the records, the bank would give her her money. As soon as she got it, she rented one of the carpenter's shacks. It was in Noborichil, near the site of her former house. And though its floor was dirt and it was dark inside, it was at least a home in Hiroshima, and she was no longer dependent on the charity of her in-laws. During the spring, she cleared away some nearby wreckage and planted a vegetable garden. She cooked with utensils and ate off plates she scavenged from the debris. She sent Maiko to the kindergarten, which the Jesuits reopened, and the two older children attended Noboricho Primary School, which, for want of buildings, held classes out of doors. Toshio wanted to study to be a mechanic, like his hero, Hideo Asaki. Prices were high. By midsummer, Mrs. Nakamura's savings were gone. She sold some of her clothes to get food. She had once had several expensive kimonos, but during the war, one had been stolen. She had given one to a sister who had been bombed out in Tokuyama. She had all lost a couple in the Hiroshima bombing, and now she sold her last one. It brought only 100 yen, which did not last long. In June, she went to Father Kleinsorge for advice about how to get along, and in early August, she was still considering the two alternatives he suggested. Taking work as a domestic for some of the Allied occupation forces, or borrowing from her relatives enough money, about 500 yen, or a bit more than $30, to repair her rusty sewing machine and resume the work of a seamstress. When Mr. Tanimoto returned from Shikoku, he draped a tent he owned over the roof of the badly damaged house he had rented in Ushida. The roof still leaked, but he conducted services in the damp living room. He began thinking about raising money to restore his church in the city. He became quite friendly with Father Kleinsorge and saw the Jesuits often. He envied them their church's wealth. They seemed to be able to do anything they wanted. He had nothing to work with except his own energy, and that was not what it had been. The Society of Jesus had been the first institution to build a relatively permanent shanty in the ruins of Hiroshima. That had been while Father Kleinsorge was in the hospital. As soon as he got back, he began living in the shack, and he and another priest, Father Lauterman, who had joined him in the mission, arranged for the purchase of three of the standardized barracks, which the city was selling at 7,000 yen apiece. They put two together, end to end, and made a pretty chapel of them. They ate in the third. When materials were available, they commissioned a contractor to build a three-story mission house exactly like the one that had been destroyed in the fire. In the compound, carpenters cut timbers, gouged mortises, shaped tenons, whittled scores of wooden pegs, and bored holes for them, until all the parts for the house were in a neat pile. Then, in 3 days, they put the whole thing together, like an oriental puzzle, without any nails at all. Father Kleinsorge was finding it hard, as Dr. Fujii had suggested he would, to be cautious and to take his naps. He went out every day on foot to call on Japanese Catholics and prospective converts. As the months went by, he grew more and more tired. In June, he read an article in the Hiroshima Chugoku warning survivors against working too hard. But what could he do? By July, he was worn out. And early in August, almost exactly on the anniversary of the bombing, he went back to the Catholic International Hospital in Tokyo for a month's rest. Whether or not Father Kleinsorge's answers to Miss Sasaki's questions about life were final and absolute truths, she seemed quickly to draw physical strength from them. Dr. Sasaki noticed it and congratulated Father Kleinsorge. By April 15th, her temperature and white count were normal, and the infection in the wound was beginning to clear up. On the 20th, there was almost no pus, and for the first time she jerked along a corridor on crutches. 5 days later, the wound had begun to heal, and on the last day of the month, she was discharged. During the early summer, she prepared herself for conversion to Catholicism. In that period, she had ups and downs. Her depressions were deep. She knew she would always be a cripple. Her fiancé never came to see her. There was nothing for her to do except read and look out from her house on a hillside in Coy across the ruins of the city where her parents and brother died. She was nervous, and any sudden noise made her put her hands quickly to her throat. Her leg still hurt. She rubbed it often and patted it as if to console it. It took 6 months for the Red Cross Hospital and even longer for Dr. Sasaki to get back to normal. Until the city restored electric power, the hospital had to limp along with the aid of a Japanese army generator in its backyard. Operating tables, x-ray machines, dentist chairs, everything complicated and essential came in a trickle of charity from other cities. In Japan, face is important even to institutions, and long before the Red Cross Hospital was back to par on basic medical equipment, its directors put up a new yellow brick veneer facade, so the hospital became the handsomest building in Hiroshima from the street. For the first 4 months, Dr. Sasaki was the only surgeon on the staff, and he almost never left the building. Then gradually, he began to take an interest in his own life again. He got married in March. He gained back some of the weight he lost, but his appetite remained only fair. Before the bombing, he used to eat 4 rice balls at every meal, but a year after it, he could manage only 2. He felt tired all the time. "But I have to realize," he said, "that the whole community is tired." A year after the bomb was dropped, Miss Sasaki was a cripple. Mrs. Nakamura was destitute. Father Kleinsorge was back in the hospital. Dr. Sasaki was not capable of the work he once could do. Dr. Fujii had lost the 30-room hospital it took him many years to acquire and had no prospects of rebuilding it. Mr. Tanimoto's church had been ruined, and he no longer had his exceptional vitality. The lives of these 6 people, who were among the luckiest in Hiroshima, would never be the same. What they thought of their experiences and of the use of the atomic bomb was, of course, not unanimous. One feeling they did seem to share, however, was a curious kind of elated community spirit, something like that of the Londoners after their Blitz, a pride in the way they and their fellow survivors had stood up to a dreadful ordeal. Just before the anniversary, Mr. Tanimoto wrote in a letter to an American some words which expressed this feeling. It read, "What a heartbreaking scene this was the first night. About midnight, I landed on the riverbank. So many injured people lied on the ground that I made my way by striding over them. Repeating, 'Excuse me,' I forwarded and carried a tub of water with me and gave a cup of water to each one of them. They raised their upper body slowly and accepted a cup of water with a bow and drank quietly, and, spilling any remnant, gave back a cup with hearty expression of their thankfulness and said, 'I couldn't help my sister who was buried under the house because I had to take care of my mother who got a deep wound on her eye, and our house soon set afire and we hardly escaped. Look, I lost my home, my family, and at last myself, bitterly injured. But now I have got in my mind to dedicate what I have and to complete the war for our country's sake.' Thus they pledged to me. Even women and children did the same. Being entirely tired, I lied down on the ground among them but couldn't sleep at all. Next morning, I found many men and women dead whom I had gave water last night. But to my great surprise, I never heard anyone cried in disorder, even though they suffered in great agony. They died in silence, with no grudge, setting their teeth to bear it, all for the country." Dr. Y. Hiraiwa, professor of Hiroshima University of Literature and Science, and one of my church members, was buried by the bomb under the 2-storied house with his son, a student of Tokyo University. Both of them could not move an inch under tremendously heavy pressure, and the house already caught fire. His son said, "Father, we can do nothing except make our mind up to consecrate our lives for the country. Let us give banzai to our emperor." And then the father followed after his son. Tenno haika, banzai, banzai, banzai. In the result, Dr. Hiraiwa said, "Strange to say, I felt calm and bright and peaceful spirit in my heart when I chanted banzai to Tenno." Afterward, his son got out and digged down and pulled out his father, and thus they were saved. In thinking of their experience at that time, Dr. Hiraiwa repeated, "What a fortunate that we are Japanese. It was my first time I ever tasted such a beautiful spirit when I decided to die for our emperor." Miss Kayoko Nobutoki, a student of girls' high school, Hiroshima Jajubian, and a daughter of my church member, was taking rest with her friends beside the heavy fence of the Buddhist temple. At the moment the atomic bomb was dropped, the fence fell upon them. They could not move a bit under such a heavy fence, and then smoke entered even a crack and choked their breath. One of the girls began to sing Kimi ga yo, national anthem, and others followed in chorus and died. Meanwhile, one of them found a crack and struggled hard to get out. When she was taken in the Red Cross hospital, she told how her friends died, tracing back in her memory to singing in chorus our national anthem. They were just 13 years old. Yes, people of Hiroshima died manly in the atomic bombing, believing that it was for emperor's sake. End quote. A surprising number of the people of Hiroshima remained more or less indifferent about the ethics of using the bomb. Possibly they were too terrified by it to want to think about it at all. Not many of them even bothered to find out much about what it was like. Mrs. Nakamura's conception of it and awe of it was typical. "The atom bomb," she would say when asked about it, "is the size of a matchbox. The heat of it was 6,000 times that of the sun. It exploded in the air. There is some radium in it. I don't know just how it works, but when the radium is put together, it explodes." As for the use of the bomb, she would say, "It was war, and we had to expect it." And then she would add, "Shikata ga nai," a Japanese expression as common as and corresponding to the Russian word Nichivo. It can't be helped. Oh well, too bad. Dr. Fujii said approximately the same thing about the use of the bomb to Father Kleinsorge one evening in German. "Da ist nichts zu machen." There's nothing to be done about it. Many citizens of Hiroshima, however, continued to feel a hatred for Americans which nothing could possibly erase. "I see," Dr. Sasaki once said, "that they are holding a trial for war criminals in Tokyo just now. I think they ought to try the men who decided to use the bomb, and they should hang them all." Father Kleinsorge and the other German Jesuit priest, who as foreigners could be expected to take a relatively detached view, often discussed the ethics of using the bomb. One of them, Father Simas, who was out at Nagatsuka at the time of the attack, wrote in a report to the Holy See in Rome. He wrote, "Some of us consider the bomb in the same category as poison gas and were against its use on a civilian population. Others were of the opinion that in total war, as carried on in Japan, there was no difference between civilians and soldiers, and that the bomb itself was an effective force tending to end the bloodshed, warning Japan to surrender and thus to avoid total destruction. It seems logical that he who supports total war in principle cannot complain of a war against civilians. The crux of the matter is whether total war in its present form is justifiable, even when it serves a just purpose. Does it not have material and spiritual evil as its consequences, which far exceed whatever good might result? When will our moralists give us a clear answer to this question. It would be impossible to say what horrors were embedded in the minds of the children who lived through the day of the bombing in Hiroshima. On the surface, their recollections, months after the disaster, were of an exhilarating adventure. Toshio Nakamura, who was 10 at the time of the bombing, was soon able to talk freely, even gaily, about the experience, and a few weeks before the anniversary, he wrote the following matter-of-fact essay for his teacher at Nabori Cho Primary School. The day before the bomb, I went for a swim. In the morning, I was eating peanuts. I saw a light. I was knocked to little sister's sleeping place. When we were saved, I could only see as far as the tram. My mother and I started to pack our things. The neighbors were walking around burned and bleeding. Hataya-san told me to run away with her. I said I wanted to wait for my mother. We went to the park. A whirlwind came. At night, a gas tank burned, and I saw the reflection in the river. We stayed in the park one night. Next day, I went to Taiko Bridge and met my girlfriends, Kikuki and Murakami. They were looking for their mothers. But Kikuki's mother was wounded, and Murakami's mother, alas, was dead. Next, from the January 5th, 1946 issue of the New Yorker magazine, the Talk of the Town section, Usher, the pilot who dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, by Eugene Kincaid. The man who was chosen by the AAF to usher in the atomic age is a dark-haired, 29-year-old full colonel named Paul W. Tibbets, Jr. He commanded the 509th Combat Squadron, which conducted a number of still-secret experiments having to do with the dropping of atomic bombs, and he piloted the plane that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. In a recent talk with Colonel Tibbets, who has been in town, we found him suitably uncommunicative about the size, shape, and characteristics of the bomb, and not too readily communicative about anything else. "I don't want to sound pompous," he said, "but I am well known among my friends and family as a fellow who does not do much talking." We did manage to worm from him the fact that he started out to be an abdominal surgeon and that he graduated from the University of Florida and spent a year and a half at the University of Cincinnati before he decided to take up flying instead of cutting. This was late in 1938. The cheapest way to learn to fly was to sign up with the Air Corps for 3 years, which he did. By the time the 3 years were up, he was a captain, and the Air Corps wanted him to stick around. Tibbets went overseas in 1942 and dropped old-fashioned bombs on North Africa and occupied France. In the fall of 43, he was called home to serve as a test pilot for B-29s. He was hard at work at this job, when one day a high-ranking general summoned him to his office, locked the door, peeked under his desk, and said, "You are a member of the Air Corps who may henceforth consider the atomic bomb your baby." Tibbets didn't know what the general was talking about. "I will only go so far as to say that I knew what an atom was," Tibbets told us. "People keep asking me these days whether I wasn't shaken by the importance of our atomic bomb work. Myself, I found that I was just as anxious as ever to finish up and get back to that steak dinner and Terry and the pirates." Tibbets' chief difficulty up to this August was in lying about what he was doing. "I'd never realized before," he said, "that the question somebody asks you every hour on the hour is, 'What have you been up to lately?' I'll bet I thought up more jobs in the Air Corps than there are in the Air Corps. Every time I ran into a guy, I had to rack my brains figuring out what I'd told him the week before. It's a wonder I had any strength left by August, or any of the rest of us who knew about what was going on. Those in the 509th who did know, aside from Tibbets, were the navigator and bombardier of his own plane, and five or six others in the squadron. Just before the New Mexico tryout, the 509th flew to a base in the Marianas. At dawn, on August 6, Marianas time, August 5 back there, the six planes in the squadron took off for Hiroshima. The crew in Tibbetts' plane, which carried the bomb, were, as Tibbetts put it, pretty busy for the first couple of hours, and it wasn't until they were well out to sea that he called, "Attention!" over the interphone system. He doesn't remember exactly what he said next. To the best of his recollection, it went something like, "Well, boys, here's the last piece in the jigsaw puzzle." The squadron had had a hand in dropping ordinary bombs on quite a lot of cities by that time. And there wasn't, Tibbetts told us, a single man in the plane who would have thought of a phrase like a new era in history. All we wanted was for the thing to go off right after all our work, he added. When the bomb was dropped, everyone craned his neck to watch the enormous black cloud that rose over the city, an effect quite different from anything any of them had ever seen. Then they flew back to the Marianas, eating ham sandwiches as they went. Tibbetts has been getting letters from relatives and friends ever since. "I think they mean to sound proud of me," he said, "but they're all sore about those stories I'd fed them. Some people have a theory that anything I do from now on will seem anticlimactic, but I feel fine. If I ever have any grandchildren, I doubt if I get a chance to tell them about the bomb. By that time, I'll be a pretty old-fashioned fellow, and they'll be telling me." And now, from the cultural comment section of the July 25th, 2023 online edition of the New Yorker magazine, "Staging Nuclear Dread in Oppenheimer and Dr. Atomic. How do you depict an event that has left a psychological scar, in some cases physical scars, on almost everyone on the planet?" By Alex Ross. The late Daniel Ellsberg, in his book The Doomsday Machine, drew attention to a curious conversation that took place between Albert Speer and Adolf Hitler in the summer of 1942 on the subject of atomic apocalypse. Speer had asked Werner Heisenberg, the physicist in charge of the faltering German nuclear program, whether an atomic explosion could lead to an uncontrolled chain reaction. Heisenberg did not rule it out. Speer wrote in his memoir, Inside the Third Reich, the following: "Hitler was plainly not delighted with the possibility that the Earth under his rule might be transformed into a glowing star. Occasionally, however, he joked that the scientists, in their unworldly urge to lay bare all the secrets under heaven, might someday set the globe on fire. But undoubtedly, a good deal of time would pass before that came about," Hitler said. "He would certainly not live to see it." In fact, as Ellsberg pointed out, Hitler killed himself less than 3 months before the first atomic device was detonated, on July 16, 1945, at what is now the White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico. The physicist of Los Alamos, led by J. Robert Oppenheimer, had also pondered the prospect of an atmosphere-igniting chain reaction, although they put the chance of such an outcome at less than 3 in a million. Enrico Fermi, less sanguine, reportedly placed the odds at 10 to 1. Ellsberg noted that these dire discussions were never shared with civilian authorities. It's unlikely that either Franklin Delano Roosevelt or Harry Truman would have called off the atomic program as a result. Yet, the withholding of information struck Ellsberg as symptomatic of a moral void. The scientists were, quote, "engaged in a longer-term gamble, imperiling the survival of humanity." Several times in the past 8 decades, the world has come shudderingly close to losing that gamble. Closest of all, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, when the Air Force General Curtis LeMay urged a strike on Soviet missile positions in Cuba. Richard Rhodes, the author of The Making of the Atomic Bomb, wrote in this magazine in 1995, quote, "If John Kennedy had followed LeMay's advice, history would have forgotten the Nazis and their terrible Holocaust. Ours would have been the historic omnicide," end quote. To which one can add, if any historians remained, the fact that no nuclear weapon has been used in combat since August 9, 1945, is the result more of pure chance than of accumulated wisdom. Ellsberg concluded tersely, "This is not a species to be trusted with nuclear weapons." The test shot that Oppenheimer named Trinity in an allusion to John Donne's sonnet, "Better My Heart, Three-Personed God," has been reenacted many times on screen. Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer is the latest in a series of attempts that go back to the stiff Hollywood docudrama The Beginning or the End, released in 1947. Three adaptations appeared in the 1980s, a time of renascent nuclear alarm: the BBC miniseries Oppenheimer, the television movie Day One, and Roland Joffe's film Fat Man and Little Boy. But Nolan's most formidable competition is, perhaps surprisingly, an opera: John Adams and Peter Sellers' Dr. Atomic, which had its first performance in 2005 in San Francisco. In the months before the Atomic premiere, I chronicled the making of the opera and visited major locales of Manhattan Project history, including the Trinity site. No sulfurous atmosphere lingers at the place. It's a patch of high desert like any other. If you look down, though, you see a couple of sheared-off metal stubs, all that remains of the 100-foot tower that held the bomb. The top of each stub is rippled like whipped cream. I thought back to the early 1980s when I was a teenager in Washington. Ronald Reagan was cracking jokes about global thermonuclear war, like, "We begin bombing in 5 minutes." And my classmates and I were discussing what we would do if the sirens began to sound. One friend said, "I'm going to walk toward the Washington Monument and close my eyes." How do you stage an event that has left a psychological scar, in some cases physical scars, on almost everyone on the planet? Mushroom clouds long ago became pop culture signifiers, detached from the hellish violence that they represent. Stanley Kubrick made them the concussive punchline of Dr. Strangelove. In Wes Anderson's Asteroid City, they become one more knick-knack of 1950s decor, alongside Formica countertops and red and white checkered tablecloths. What's impossible to capture is the awe that the site induced in its first observers, even though most of them had a reasonably good idea of what to expect. Oppenheimer, despite the huge resources that are put into play, presents an oddly rushed, jumbled vision of Trinity. Part of the difficulty is that the Manhattan Project occupies only the middle third of a sprawling biopic, one that combines the stylistic incoherence of Oliver Stone with the didactic insistence of William Dieterle. The fraught hours leading up to the explosion, an overnight thunderstorm, bets on the size of the blast, nagging fears of Armageddon are confined to about 8 minutes of screen time. Nolan's preference for hectic cutting and close-ups means that we never fully register the blank immensity of the landscape. Dr. Atomic, in contrast, confines itself to the weeks leading up to Trinity, arriving at the eve of the test before the end of the first act. Both the opera and the film include a scene in which Oppenheimer is seen alone at the tower, communing with the tentacled bomb. Cillian Murphy, who plays the physicist in the movie, gazes at it silently, his face wavering between fascination and terror. In Atomic, Oppenheimer sings a gravely lamenting aria titled "Batter My Heart." Opera's capacity to voice interior monologues has redoubled force as we confront the sheer weirdness of the association. Donne's poem of divine assault and ravishment renders Trinity as the site of some sort of masochistic ritual. Oppenheimer's florid literary self-stylizations are essential to the legendary status that he has acquired. His most grandiose gesture was to claim, years after the fact, that the detonation had put him in mind of the Hindu god Vishnu. quote, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds," end quote. This loose translation of the Bhagavad Gita is recited twice in Oppenheimer, the first time during an inadvertently hilarious sex scene. Atomic wisely leaves the line out. Mythological allusions have proliferated in tellings of the physicist's life. In Nolan's film, he is called an American Prometheus, in keeping with the title of Kai Bird and Martin J. Sherwin's Oppenheimer biography. Atomic, for its part, arose in response to San Francisco Opera's request for a work about an American Faust figure. Such narratives risk personalizing a historical situation that has little to do with one man's pretentious inner demons. Atomic, in its final minutes, resolves the Oppenheimer problem by letting him recede into the background. In a nod to Einstein's theory of relativity, Adams bends time during the countdown so that 5 minutes are stretched out to almost 15. The explosion takes the form of a darkly shimmering chord for mass strings with a flash of winds and muted brass on top. This, Adams told me in 2005, was the test seen from afar. After that false dawn, quiet bell chords toll, and we hear the voice of a Japanese woman begging for water. Some of her words taken from John Hersey's Hiroshima. In the film, too, Trinity is implicitly transmuted into Hiroshima. At a celebratory gathering at Los Alamos, Oppenheimer hallucinates radiation burns on his colleagues' faces. Yet Nolan generally pays little heed to the issue of fallout, which Los Alamos doctors tried to raise and which Leslie Groves, the chief of the Manhattan Project, dismissed. Dr. Atomic takes note of Groves' indifference. He asks the physician, "What are you, a Hearst propagandist?" Casting the story as the tragic arc of a mythic individual not only obscures the collective nature of the effort, but amounts to an exercise in scapegoating. Yet myths can sometimes show us the recurrence of fatal patterns that a more unsentimental approach might overlook. And Faust, who made a contract with the devil, is surely a better archetype than Prometheus, who stole fire from the gods. Even on a 100-degree day, Trinity possesses a chilling aura. In that place, a new kind of evil came into the world. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.